convene. Please be seated. Before we call our second case of the morning, my notes tell me that we have a high school class here, Sussex Hamilton High School. Another group, we had a group from Sussex Hamilton for the first argument. Is that correct? And if it is, would they and their teacher please stand? Oh, my, wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us. Please be seated. We very much like to have students come and participate in courtroom class. It's good for the court to see a full courtroom out there, and it's also, I think, good for you all to get a taste of what it's like at the Wisconsin Supreme Court at a time when, who knows, you may decide to be lawyers so that you can be judges and do some of the work that you'll see done here today. Generally, we have a justice meet with the class after this argument, but I understand you all have to move on, so that won't occur today, but we very much appreciate your coming to visit with us. Now, we've seen who you are, at least a little bit, and so I'd like to introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Michael Gableman. Next to Justice Gableman is Justice David Prosser. Next to him is Justice Shirley Abrahamson.
I was supposed to talk with you at noon, and you can't make it, but I have offered to come to Sussex. If Sussex won't come here, I'll come to Sussex.
I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to me on my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her is Annette Ziegler, and on the far left is Justice Rebecca Bradley. So with those introductions in line, we are ready for our second case, Prince versus Vandenberg. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do.
Morning. May it please the court. I'm George Burnett. I represent the appellants in this case. As the court is aware, this is a garnishment action. And before the court are three specific issues. The first issue stated directly is, did the Court of Appeals lose the forest for the trees in concluding the Department of Revenue was entitled to $85,000 rather than $28,000 in this action. Number two, did the Circuit Court abuse or erroneously exercise its discretion when it rejected partition of the land contract proceeds, which happens to be the only path out of this legal quagmire? And number three is, simply put, do pleadings still matter in the state of Wisconsin? Does the claim, the answer by the Department of Revenue somehow substitute for a summons and complaint in garnishment in this case? So turning to the first question, did the Court of Appeals lose its way? The Court of Appeals concluded in this case that based on a statute, 700.21, the Department of Revenue was entitled to $85,000. It reasoned that $85,000 was 25% of the land contract price. Section 700.21 of the statute says a tenant in common, like Mr. Vandenberg, the debtor was here, has a claim to 25% of the purchase price, is what the statute says. So from that, the Court of Appeals reasoned that because Mr. Vandenberg had a claim to 25% of the purchase price, that was the appropriate garnishable amount.
Mr. Burnett, I know you're just first getting into the argument, but this is the record of the case. And I asked the marshal whether there were separate boxes. This is a very complicated case, just a land contract, two payments that have been made. It deals with four co-tenants. It deals with the Department of Revenue. It deals with mortgages and other liens, right?
Correct.
All of that's involved. And there is no other record before us. Now, okay, that's what I want to know, because what's before us here is the documents that... which are the summons and the complaint and affidavits and the judgment. And, you know, they're all here, but, you know, there are multiple pages of each, but nothing much. And then it's the transmission of a copy and notice appeal. So is this it?
No, it's not. The certification of the record from the clerk.
Why I asked the question, other than it looked strange to me. I'm
120
also asking,
different items.
Yeah, I'm also asking the question because as when I went through what we had in my file, and I don't have the full record. I mean, you have an appendix in this.
Right.
It just seemed to me there weren't enough facts here for the court to make a decision. I mean, how do I know, I'm sorry, that there's 85,000 or that how much is left on the fourth payment?
That's
I don't know that.
Well, that's the pleadings, Your Honor, that the court evidently doesn't have. There will be an answer from the garnishee defendant, Mr. Vandehei, which will set that out in detail.
That is in the appendix.
How do I know what happened to the money and whether all these liens, were some of them were paid off? Because at the end of the land contract, you got to get full title, full marketable clear title, right, without any liens. So how do we know
There are no affidavits in the record that reveal that information, right. So to that extent, the court would be accurate. There's no sworn proof. However, in Mr. Vandehei's answer, he sets out that detail. He sets out the amount of the debt is $28,000 and change. That is enough under garnishment. If we assume what the Department of Revenue did was actually a garnishment complaint, and the reason I say that is under the statutes, 812.14, if my memory serves me correctly, unless the garnishee defendant's answer is traversed, it's conclusive. Now, in this particular case, Prince, the original institutor of this action, traversed the answer. It disputed what the debt was. But the Department of Revenue never did. That leads into really the third question, which is what is going to serve as a pleading, a claim in this state?
And that, Mr. Burnett, you said you were going to address as your third issue, but I am very interested in that. 812.17, tells us that in interpleader, upon such service being made, such claimant shall be deemed a defendant. Here, the DOR is saying, that's us. In the garnishee action, and within 20 days shall answer setting forth the claimant's claim. The DOR argues that its answer is sufficient because it did list the tax warrant numbers. The priority is there because the tax warrant liens having been docketed, having been filed sometime before the Prince judgment creditor lien. Why isn't compliance with 812.17 enough?
Because it didn't comply with 812.17.
Okay. In what way?
What happened here was a frustration. Prince had a judgment lien on this real estate. Instead of foreclosing a judgment lien, it filed a garnishment action on land contract proceeds. When it filed that garnishment action, it didn't name my clients, even though their name would be on the check.
It didn't name the DOR.
Didn't name the DOR, didn't name the mortgage holder. So one of the things we did when, after the circuit court rendered its original decision, is I went to the court and I said, this doesn't make any sense. There are a lot of problems. There are other parties that may have an interest in this real estate that should be in the case. The circuit court ultimately concluded that that my clients were not necessary and indispensable parties, even though their names would be on the check. Now, so what happened? I brought a third-party summons and complaint, but not in garnishment. If you read the third-party summons and complaint, it is a complaint for partition. It asks the court to partition the proceeds of the land contract. I asked the circuit court to dismiss the garnishment case for failure to comply with Chapter 803 because Prince ignored parties with a prior interest. So to answer the court's question, the statute that the court alludes to is a statute that requires Prince to bring in additional parties, and once those additional parties are brought in, they must answer. The Department of Revenue here didn't answer a garnishment complaint. I attached the garnishment complaint to the third-party complaint because that's what you always do, and expressly alleged it is solely for purpose of showing the nature of the underlying action. Prince never sued the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue never sued Mr. Vandehei. It never cross-claimed against my clients, and it never cross-claimed against Prince, and it never complied with Chapter 812, which requires that it pay a garnishee a fee, nominal $3, but it didn't comply. And then it didn't traverse the answer that the garnishee defended had filed previously. So here we have a case where the Department of Revenue didn't follow Chapter 812 at all. Instead, what it says is you've got to look at our answer, which is to paragraph 15, which alleges it may have an interest in the property, and it says, yes, we do, and here are our tax warrants. And then in its wherefore clause, it says, give us judgment consistent with what we've alleged above. If that serves as a garnishment, summons, and complaint in this state, we have lost all regimen over pleading.
Counselor, if the response of the DOR is in line with your impleader action that you filed, why can't we say that they're seeking whatever part we decide is appropriate of this money that's sitting out there, okay, as a tax levy under 7191 sub 6, which doesn't require a judgment, and I don't know that anybody argued that. I have a bad habit of trying to figure out the problems, particularly these kind of cases, which I love because I think they're so interesting. But I see the problems you're saying, and I'm trying to figure out, well, what's really going on here? You know, they got a tax levy they're working on because that's the only way that they're ahead of Prince, because at the moment they're fighting to get the money from Prince. They're less concerned about your clients. And 7191.6 seems to permit DOR to do this and then to step ahead of Prince based on the filing date for the levy, which is ahead of the filing date for Prince's judgment.
To answer your question, let me make an already complicated situation more complicated.
Probably.
What the court is referring to is Chapter 71, which confers substantive rights on the DOR. It has nothing to do with procedure.
Yep.
What I'm referring to is procedural rights. If we start in Professor Feynman's first day of his civil procedure class, what we hear is that lawsuits are based on claims. under the federal rules of, now the state rules of civil procedure, we have to articulate a short and plain statement of our claim. We don't plead facts. We don't plead legal theories. We plead claims for relief. But the first thing any litigant has to do is go to the court with a claim for relief. In this case, we have no complaint. We have no answer. We have no traversing an answer. We have no motion. We have no affidavit. And we have no judgment. If the court looks at the record, if it arrives, what the court will see is a series of letters between counsel for the DOR, Mr. McAnally at the time, myself and Judge Hammer. And after the court issued its decision on reconsideration, the DOR sent a judgment to the court, and I objected to it. I said, what the court has done is essentially issued an advisory opinion based on facts that it thought it had before it, which are not established. Do not sign the judgment. And Judge Hammer wrote back, declined to sign the judgment, and the DNR had asked whether they should file a subsequent garnishment action, and the circuit court appropriately declined to give that advice. That makes this an extra complicated case, because if the court has given an advisory opinion, there's no jurisdiction. And that is why this case is about whether pleadings matter, whether a litigant has to tell the court what they claim and what relief they want.
So what you're saying is essentially when DOR responded, they should have responded by filing a summons and complaint in garnishment if they wanted to go after the money that everybody was focusing on and pled it in that regard rather than the way that they did. Is that
probably
saying?
A cross claim
with
an appropriate summons and the garnishee fee.
Well, I do find it confusing. I do find the interplay among all the statutes mentioned confusing for this particular case anyway. And so I would like to turn, if you would, to the partition issue.
Sure.
As I understand it, but I could be wrong, the four co-tenants want partition and sale. Is that right?
Three.
Pardon me?
Three want partition. Mr. Vandenberg has not participated.
Okay. And the buyer is willing for partition and sale, right?
Correct.
And the real, the person or entity objecting is the DOR.
And right? Prince objected.
Pardon me?
Prince objected as well.
Okay. So you're lien holders, broadly using the words object.
Correct.
Now, as I envision partition, usually the co-tenants aren't getting along for one reason or other or disagree. And they call for partition, and each one gets 2 acres of the 8 acres, and then they can do what they want. And if you can't divide up the property in that kind of way, then the court will order a sale, and you divide up the money, right?
Right.
Okay. So how will partition play out here?
Partition would play out this way, Your Honor. The real estate, the sale with Mr. Vandehei would be completed if it's a fair market sale.
Right, okay.
He's already paid 2/3 of the purchase price.
And the court that determines the partition action will determine whether it's a fair market.
Correct.
Okay.
Much so like in a...
Because this is an equitable
equity
procedure. And okay, all right.
Then we would not partition the real estate, we would partition the sale proceeds.
That's right, but you'd put it up for sale.
Correct.
Okay.
The sale proceeds would be divided 25-25, 25-25, and Mr. Vandenberg, the debtor's proceeds, would pay his creditors in the order they're entitled to receive it according to law. $28,000. At the time, it would have been the Department of Revenue.
And that's James's fair share?
That's James's fair share.
Okay. Now, that's assuming that in the other payouts, they were divided equally.
Correct.
Right?
Which they would be, but...
Pardon me?
Which they would be.
They were all one-fourth owners.
All one-fourth owners. And there is proof of that in the record in a affidavit from the buyer or the buyer's attorney. I should add that the question, and this is the key part, and this is why partition is the only way to get this real estate out of legal purgatory. It is the...
That's why I'm asking this question.
And the question is, well, how do you foreclose these other lien interests? The short answer is based on 842.14 sub 3. That statute says that if partition is adjudged, existing liens shall not be affected or impaired, except that a lien upon an undivided interest or estate, that's us, shall thereafter be a charge only on the share assigned to the party against whom it exists, and then the statute goes on. So how it would happen, work in the real world, it would be these liens follow the $28,000 that goes to Mr. Vandenberg. They are, the $28,000 is paid according to legal priority. The liens then disappear because the proceeds disappear. And Mr. Vandenhey, who is paid $250,000, gets his property upon final payment.
If he buys it at the foreclosure, at the sale.
At the sale.
Okay.
But if we don't order partition, then there's going to have to be another way of paying off all of these debts because we've already seen in the record there was a motion for specific performance and the court said it's not ripe yet. There is a contractual obligation to transfer to Vandenhey free and clear of all of these obligations.
And that's why,
right?
The Court of Appeals decision has made chaos in this area of the law. Because now creditors who have judgment liens have no incentive to foreclose those liens. They have every incentive, if there's co-tenants of the property, to pass... To hang on to those liens because their co-tenants have to answer for their partner's debts. They have the creditors have received a windfall. And Mr. Vandenberg has no incentive to declare bankruptcy and discharge some of these debts because somebody else is paying his bills. That's the problem with what the Court of Appeals did. Can I just say one thing that I was going to say at the outset of this argument because I don't want it to be lost? I began by saying the Court of Appeals lost the forest for the trees by relying on 700.21. What the Court of Appeals failed to note was that garnishes, when someone garnishes, you don't garnish a purchase price. You garnish a debt.
So you garnish what belongs to the defendant in the possession of a third party.
Correct.
Right.
And the debt here was $113,000. So if you want to apply 700.21 to the debt, the figure is $28,000. Now, Justice Abramson, I don't know if I fully answered your concerns.
Well, I understand the partition. I understand the equitable nature. I understand that this purchase price by Vandenhey is valid. Otherwise, it's a fraud on maybe everybody. And so I understand that. What's not clear to me, in light of the other payouts that were given here, is... this property is laden with liens.
Right.
You got the M&I mortgage. You got maybe the Department of Revenue. You've got Jackson having used his share as collateral for loans, if I understand the facts.
Correct. And time has marched on, so it's outside the record, but...
But how do they, how at a petition and a sale, can you give this property in accordance with the land contract terms, or outside the land contract terms, free and clear? I don't understand that from what's before us.
From what is before you, it cannot happen because judgment lien creditors are entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard.
Sure.
And a complaint would need to be amended for partition to include everybody else who might claim an interest in this property. But the liens would be foreclosed by virtue of 842.14 sub 3, which is the statute that I had read that said those liens attached to Vandenberg's share, and once that share is gone of the proceeds, the property passes.
Who do you sell it to? You already have a buyer.
That's who I would suggest it be sold to. In fairness to the creditors, I'm sure the circuit court would say we need to make sure that Mr. Vandehei is paying fair market value so the creditors don't get more.
That's right. That's the fraud, potential fraud piece here.
Correct. So this would require a remand for the court or the circuit court to explore partition. Otherwise, you're absolutely right, Chief Justice Rogenczak. This case is in limbo forever.
Well, but if you send it back, you would reverse the Court of Appeals and send it back to the circuit court, right?
Correct.
And what would the instructions be? Are the instructions that appropriate documents should be drafted and filed regarding partition?
Right. The court should, you'd have to find the court erroneously exercise its discretion because it misapprehended what Mr. Vandehei's position was and didn't fully understand, as you read the circuit court opinion, what it was being asked to do. The circuit court didn't appear to appreciate it was being asked to partition proceeds, even though we did file a brief setting forth that, not the real estate. So I think the court's mistaken as to the facts, which is an ample ground for reversal of a discretionary decision. I see my red light is on.
And the discretionary I'm sorry. What was the discretionary decision with?
Not to partition the property.
Okay. Justice
Brasser.
Mr. Vandenberg had many liens against his property.
Correct.
When we're talking about the whole property, all this real estate that has four owners, are the liens against the entire property or only against the quarter of the property that was owned by Mr.
The liens are against Vandenberg's interest, which is an undivided one-quarter interest. So the property cannot be sold without expunging those liens. If the court were to partition the real estate, the liens don't follow the real estate that go to the innocent tenants in common. But that's not what we asked the court to do, and I don't think that would be acceptable to Mr. Vandehei.
You said something before where I thought you distinguished 700.21.
Yes.
From the garnishment statute.
Correct. The appropriate garnishment statute is 812.18.
Yes.
And that says from the time of service upon the garnishee shall be liable to the creditor for, that talks about property, and for all the garnishee's debts due or to become due to the debtor except as are exempt from execution. So that statute says you don't garnish purchase prices, you garnish debts. And I should add, garnishment's inappropriate here anyway because 8.12.19, right after it, talks about you may not garnish a contingent debt. Well, this was a contingent debt. My clients had to provide clear title. That was raised at the circuit court, and the circuit court rejected it. It was not raised again at the Court of Appeals. So I don't know if that is something the court would consider or not.
That's not in your brief. I didn't notice any of that in your brief.
It wasn't.
It seems to me, in some respects, you're benefited by the garnishment. Because you're relying, to some extent, on 8.12.18. But what would happen if there were no garnishments here at all?
If there were no garnishments here at all, then my clients would have to go to Mr. Vandenberg and say, you need to declare bankruptcy in order to expunge these interests, or they'd have to negotiate with the lien creditors, or Mr. Vandenberg would, or they'd have to attempt to foreclose the real estate themselves, or they'd have to make themselves creditors of Mr. Vandenberg so they could put him into an involuntary bankruptcy. There would be ways to do it, but nothing easy. Or they wait 20 years and the judgments expire. Justice Bradley, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you. You asserted that there was erroneous exercise of discretion because there was a mistake of fact. The mistake of fact that you assert was that the circuit court didn't understand that you asked to partition the proceeds and not the real estate.
Correct.
Is there any other mistake of fact or law that you would point to in the circuit court's decision or the Court of Appeals?
It's always hard to suggest that a circuit court has erroneously exercised its discretion in a matter of equity by making a legal mistake. But I think to the extent that the circuit court failed to appreciate it had the right to partition proceeds, that's a legal error.
My sense is, in reading the circuit court's decision, several times it made reference to not partitioning at this time. My guess is at this time was used maybe three times, maybe four in the circuit court's decision. So I don't know how you can say that it didn't think it had the power to do that or the ability to do it. It just wasn't going to do it at this time, as I read it.
But it dismissed the case, so at this time ended the case. And I don't know if it intended that that dismissal be without prejudice or not. So I had the right to bring a subsequent partition action. Part of the circuit court's problem, I think, was this isn't a routine case. And the court was concerned legitimately about some of the things that Justice Abramson is concerned about. What about a sale? How does that work? Well, in a foreclosure matter, which essentially this would become, you figure those things out later. You order partition, and then the details are worked out as the through the litigation process. You don't have a plan, and this is how it's going to go at the beginning.
Were there any liens on the entire property? You're talking about liens on Mr. V's 1/4 share, which he could use as his share could be used as collateral. Well, when they bought the property, was there a mortgage that covered the whole property? Was that the M&I, or is there?
I think the M&I was a loan made to Vandenberg. I can tell the court that the M&I is now, from my information, gone.
Okay, but is there a lien on the entire property, or are the liens only on his share?
Their liens are only on each share. In our third-party summons and complaint, we allege the contents of a title report that was obtained on this property at the time of the sale.
Okay.
Unless I'm missing any questions, I know I'm way past my time. Thank you.
Thank you. one other question. I'm sorry, but you can think about it or answer it now. Of these three alternatives, I assumed you wanted the partition one. You thought that was the easiest one to handle.
Yeah, I think as a matter of practical wisdom, the partition issue is the only concern that will give the lower court some direction as to how to proceed.
And finish up the matter.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Murphy. I represent Respondent Department of Revenue in this case. So this is a garnishment case. It comes out of a land sale where liens against the land are far in excess of the sale price. The sellers are four tenants in common, and one of those has judgment and tax debt. The question is, what happens to what money out of that sale? The courts below reached the correct and sensible conclusion.
You know, counsel, I'm very interested in the 812-17 issue. Your opposing counsel, Mr. Burnett, said if you pay careful attention or if you observe, you will see that we, the interveners, filed for partition. Now, if it was garnishment, I can see where you would be proceeding under 812-17, and you would say our answer to the interpleader was sufficient. And I think that's probably what you're going to say. Well, yes?
Yes.
Why is Mr. Burnett wrong that, now, I see that there was intervention. The interveners moved, and I don't remember the date off the top of my, in January 2012, Prince initiated a garnishment proceeding by serving Vandehay and James Vandenberg with a garnishment summons and complaint. And then I see on March 19, 2012, the interveners who were not yet parties to the case filed a responsive pleading stating that the interveners were interested parties. And on May 2nd, 2012, the interveners filed a motion to intervene. In which cause of action did they file a motion to intervene?
Garnishment.
And that was the garnishment action filed by Prince.
That's right.
Okay.
This is a garnishment case. I don't think that's reasonably disputable. And the garnishment complaint was attached to the third-party complaint that brought the Department of Revenue into this case. Department of Revenue...
Say that again.
The garnishment complaint filed by Prince
yes.
was an attachment to the complaint by the interveners that brought the Department of Revenue into this case.
Okay, yes.
It is clear to anyone examining or looking at this record, this is a garnishment case. The Department of...
When you say attached, do you mean it was also incorporated by reference? Or something can be attached as an exhibit or something.
It was attached as an exhibit. I don't remember the language used, if it says attached or incorporated herein or not, but it was an exhibit.
But when we go back, several of us, and go back and look through the court file, and we see which numbers matched up with the court filing numbers to see where the intervention took place by the interveners, which file will we find it in? Will the numbers match up with the garnishment action?
The complaint is attached as Exhibit A. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Those exhibits?
In the circuit court, there's only one case here, only one case number. And it was in that garnishment action.
Yes. Okay.
Where the third-party complaint was filed, attaching the garnishment complaint. And the Department of Revenue simply filed an answer tracking 812-17, saying, yes, we're here. This is our interest. This is what we are entitled to. It would demand judgment. The doctrine of construing pleadings liberally and in favor of resolving cases on their merits compels the result, then, that the Department of Revenue get the benefit of the facts that it pled, which is garnishment in this case. To respond to a couple points that were made, I think it's important to note on the partition remedy that what was requested by the interveners below in the trial court was not to hold a sale to sell this property. It was to complete the sale that was made 4 years in advance with no input from any of the lien holders, and then confine or assign the remaining portions of that sale to the lien holders, and then deem the liens terminated eliminate them without any input or opportunity to object from the lien holders. That would be prejudicial to the lien holders, and it was well within the circuit court's discretion to not grant that remedy. I also think there's a matter of clarification that's important with the idea that a garnishment is for a debt. And that's not quite right. I believe Justice Rogensack said it more correctly, that garnishment is a way, is a collection remedy for to get property in the hands of a third party. Here, Vandehei is holding property that will be paid to the debtor. And the issue here is who gets the money. The Department of Revenue is the top priority claimant to the debtor's portion of
the... And the debtor here is James Vandenberg.
That's right.
So, as I understand, my recollection is you're asking for the one quarter of the entire sales price. Yes. Even though that two-thirds of the sales price has already been paid, and that's gone.
It has been paid to the best we know on the record. I do not think...
Has been paid what?
The best we have, the best information on the record is, yes, is that two of the three payments have been made.
Right, and there's one more payment remaining.
Of a third.
$113,000, approximately.
Yes.
And that divided by four to represent the one-fourth interest of each of the interveners is approximately $28,475. Yes?
Yes.
So why isn't the Department of Revenue entitled to $28,475 representing Mr. James Vandenberg, the debtor's portion of the last remaining payment?
A couple of reasons. One is that conclusion requires the assumption that a quarter of the first two payments went to James Vandenberg, but that's no longer available to be garnished. The record does not support that.
What does the record support?
The record supports there are no facts on that issue. And so the Court of Appeals was correct here to decide the case on the straightforward property law, establishing that the debtor's portion is 25% of the sale proceeds, and on the facts that are supportable by the record in this case.
Yeah, but you just got done agreeing with Chief Justice Rogensack's definition of a garnishment, which is property owed to another held in the hands of a third party.
Right.
I maybe just butchered that, and I'll hear about it later. But I'm pretty close.
Yes.
So right now, what I see in the record is that Vandehei, the purchaser, has the last payment of $113,000, theoretically has it, and is ready to make the payment. And so the property, if we all agree, and there's nothing in the record to indicate different, if we all agree that they're one quarter owners apiece, James Vandenberg is entitled to one quarter of that $113,000.
That requires a factual finding that each of the first two payments were split into quarters.
Counselor, why does it? Do you think that Mr. Vandenberg could sue the purchaser and demand the $85,000 figure? What basis would he have it on? You know, the case that I think is really controlling is really Judge Ike's careful opinion in Miracle Feeds, which specifically says that the garnisher in a garnishment action can get no more than the debtor himself is entitled to receive. And there was an assignment of proceeds from milk checks, so the debtor had no right to them at all. The bank that was trying to do a workout with the farmer had all rights to them, and so there was a garnishment of them. And monies were given, and we overturned it. The Court of Appeals, overturned it, saying, what you look at in garnishment is what does the debtor have a right to receive? So forget about what was done with the other payments. In $113,900, is there anything in the record that would show that Mr. Vandenberg had a right to more than the $28,000 figure, a quarter of that payment?
On the record in this case, I can't think of any reason why James Vandenberg could not bring a simple contract action to recover $28,000 from the seller.
He's not an owner of any more than 25%. What would he base it on?
He'd have
to allege something other than this is a final payment on a contract.
$85,000 is one quarter. So that's his interest.
Okay, it's not one quarter of $113,900.
That's right.
That's the payment.
That's right.
The payment. Just move yourself back. Say this is the first payment. Okay, this is the first payment. And there's a garnishment action on the first payment. Is that what you're really arguing here, that we look at this as though it's the first payment, and so you give him out of the first payment everything he'd be entitled to down the road when he has no right to it until those points are met by the payments? Generally, garnishment, you repeatedly garnish somebody if there are payments due.
Right. No. What the Department of Revenue here is entitled to is the 25% of the total. Because
why? Why?
Because
the total is not being paid in 113.9. That's the point that's bothering me. Why?
113.9 is still payable. James's portion is 85. There is nothing to suggest.
Yeah, you're buying into the answer to the question, and that's the part that's bothering me. I want to know why,
right,
when you're getting one-third of the purchase price, James has any right to more than 25% of that. That's what is bothering me.
He is not.
Okay.
But the entire contract price, I don't have the number, 400,000 in sum, is the operative number, not the 113.9.
Okay, now, just a minute. When I said to you, why is he entitled to more than 25% of the payment, you said he is not. When you say he is not, that is all you can get in garnishment, what he could get.
But
you can't get more than he could get.
But 25% is 85,000.
25% of the entire
yes.
sale.
Yes.
Each other, but thank you.
Counsel, if we change the facts, and then I do want to get to the facts to make sure I'm on the same page with the facts you have. But let's just say it's someone who has a job and they earn $1,000 a month. You could garnish those wages, right?
Yes.
And if they had a big bonus coming at the end of the year, you could garnish on the bonus that's coming to them, right?
Yes.
Okay. If their annual salary, if you figure out that you want to do the garnishment in November, but their annual salary is whatever you want to make it, $100,000. You can't go back and say, oh, gosh, I want to garnish January, February, March, April, May, through November, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Isn't that in part what you're trying to do here?
No, because in the wage comparison, you know that that person got the first 11 months of his $100,000 salary. We do not know that here.
Can I ask you a couple practical questions
yes.
about here? I look at the land contract. There are four people involved in that. I think we all agree, right?
Yes.
Sharon Kempen, Sandra Schmidt, James Vandenberg, and Mark Vandenberg, right?
Yes.
Okay. To me, it kind of looks like when you look at the dollar figures coming out of this, James Vandenberg and the interveners, and who are the interveners?
Oh, the other three sellers.
Okay.
Sharon and I have their names in front of me, the other three sellers.
All right. They're each going to be paid in three payments, kind of like the checks that you got in January, February, and March, but you didn't start the garnishment till November, right?
That would be unusual in a case where there are liens that exceed the sale price. The more normal thing to do would be to set the money aside, to use it to satisfy a lien so you can comply with your contract at the end of it and deliver to your clear title. That would be the more normal, more sensible thing to do. We don't have the facts here to know which happened, but I don't think this court should make a decision based on an assumption about the money being split up when that's not in the record.
Counselor, how do you get around Judge Ike's statement that a garnishee has in his possession amounts belonging to the defendant, so that's what you're garnishing, on the date the garnishment was filed? So what the purchaser has in the purchaser's possession on the date the garnishment was filed, that on that date belongs to the defendant. It seems to me you have the proof problem to show he didn't get money and he's not been paid as one would expect his quarter share, rather than somebody else having the burden of showing. You're stepping in and saying, I want that money, and on this date, you're saying, I want it as though there's been no payment at all to him of his 25% interest. Why don't you have the burden to show that?
I just think the decision should be best made on the facts that we have in the record, which is that $113,000 is yet to be paid. The debtor's portion of the sale is less than that. It's still totally payable, $85,000. And there's just nothing in the facts to suggest that any lesser amount is appropriate here.
I have to go back to the facts again. Oops, sorry.
Go ahead.
Can I just finish with making sure I've got the facts right?
Yep.
All right. The land contract says that these four people are going to receive a total of $341,700, right?
Yes.
That's going to be accomplished through three payments that'll be made, right?
Yes.
So two of the three payments are made before the garnishment, right?
Yes.
The third payment is due, and that's when the garnishment occurs, right?
Yes.
So as far as you know, these four people are going to receive a total of $341,700.
So the four sellers, right?
Four
I'm sorry,
sellers.
The sellers, yes.
Three payments.
Four people,
right.
The
yes.
people on the land contract, the
yes.
people who the $341,700 would be due, will receive a quarter of that,
they
as
are,
far as this record reflects.
They
right?
are the payees on the contract, that's right.
Okay, are you saying they're not going to receive a quarter? The record reflects something else?
No, it'd be much more normal in a situation like this for that money to be used to satisfy liens, so that the sale could be done clear as it is intended to do, but we don't have facts on those issues.
Except, why would I want to pay Justice Bradley's debt when I'm on, you know, doing this land contract deal to
yep.
make sure she pays off her portion, but I still get my fair share of
well,
what's coming on this?
Just to continue the parties in your hypothetical, because both of you entered into a land contract promising to deliver free and clear of liens that were of record attached to the property when you entered that contract and that you knew about.
Okay,
there's
so you're saying I have to find a way to pay off her debt and then sue her. Is that what you're saying I need to do in order to I need to give up my possible profit or the amount I have coming to me on this because the whole thing is subject to payment of any one of the four of our debts.
In short, yes, but that was the agreement that was made. These were liens on the property when the sellers entered into the land contract, when they promised to deliver clear title. How they decided to arrange that or construe it among themselves is a contract problem, not a garnishment problem. So
you're just saying I just made a bad contract. I just agreed to pay off her debts.
That is one way of looking at it, yes. Whether it was a bad decision or a calculated decision or they were relying on a bankruptcy filing, we just don't know. That's not in the facts here, but it was a contract decision.
And so you get to your $85,000 because you say a quarter of $341,700 is $85-something.
That's right.
Not a quarter of what's still coming.
That's right.
Just the $113,900.
That's right.
Your argument is based, if I understand it, the argument is based on not knowing what happened to the first two payments.
Primarily.
Right. And so you don't know what happened to the first two payments. He might have gotten zilch from the first two payments.
That's right.
Because that may have been a deal among the four of them, right?
Yes.
And there's nothing the matter with them making a deal about how to distribute each of these payments.
There can be a problem. We don't know if it exists
right.
here. That implicates fraudulent transfer rules.
Yeah. Well, it may or may not.
Right.
We just don't know. If I decided not to take my 1/4 because I thought that one of my siblings needed it more then, and then I'll just take a bigger share from the second payment or third payment, that would not be a fraud. Make that. That may be a contract and it may have ramifications. But
it may be a fraudulent transfer in the sense of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. I don't know if we want to go there.
No, I don't want to
okay.
go there. I'm already complicated.
Okay.
Already too complicated for me. Okay. So your position is you don't know how the first two payments were split. Therefore, you're assuming that he's entitled to more than 1/4 of the last. And if he's entitled to more than one-fourth, then you, his debtor, his creditor, is entitled to more than one-fourth. That's because, as I started out, we don't have all the facts here. Isn't that right?
That's right. That's right. And the Court of Appeals made a decision based on the clearly applicable property law, saying that 25% is the amount of garnishable, and made the correct decision on all the facts that are supportable by the record in this case. So, yes.
Counselor, I'd like to read to you paragraph 10 out of the intervener's complaint that got DOR involved, that was never controverted by DOR. Vendor made the first two payments under the land contract in a timely fashion. Each payment was distributed three-quarters to cross-claimants, these are the other three purchasers, sellers, and one-quarter was applied to liens filed against Vandenberg on his one-fourth interest of property. The first two payments owed to James Vandenberg went to M&I Bank. So it appears we do know what happened to the payments in the past. We do know that the other people got, out of each payment, they got three quarters, and one quarter was applied to Jim Vandenberg's debt. So it's not that we don't know. You didn't controvert that. That's a fact that's admitted, if not controverted.
Well, in fairness, what you have is an allegation.
Yeah, it should have been controverted if it was incorrect. I mean, that's what pleadings are for. They set out facts. If you don't agree with them, you can disagree with them. But you didn't controvert that fact. So your argument is based on our ignoring paragraph 10.
I don't believe the Department of Revenue admitted those allegations.
I don't believe they controverted them.
Well,
did they controvert them and say, no, they're not true? I didn't see that in your pleadings, but maybe I missed it.
There's roots in the answer. I think that's a lack of information sufficient to form a belief. And
say that again. I'm sorry.
Denied upon insufficient knowledge.
Right. I would just submit the decision. This was a litigated case after that. The interveners filed two affidavits and appeared and argued at a hearing. And I would encourage the court to make a decision on the facts in the case, on the evidence and not the allegations.
According to the Court of Appeals decision, you got $85,000.
Yes.
What if the underlying facts really don't justify that? You're just willing to take the money?
I think the best facts in the record, the best decisions that we can make on the facts support that. And the interveners had opportunity to enter evidence below supporting a contrary position if they wanted to. They did file affidavits. They did appear at a hearing. And all we could do better than that now is for a do-over. And I don't think the court decision below should be reversed based on facts that were not before them. I think as a final matter on...
There's certainly the possibility here, according to pleadings and the representations of Mr. Burnett, that you'd be getting far more than you're really entitled to under the law. And you're saying, oh, that's okay with us. They didn't do their job.
I think that's a possibility.
You're basically saying that he's misrepresenting the facts to the court today.
I think there's a possibility and suggestion of that anytime one party is unhappy with the outcome of a civil case. I do not know of any misrepresentations, not suggesting that any lies are being told here. But where the factual portions of a case are decided are in the trial court. And the evidence here supports the outcome of the Court of Appeals, and that's a decision that can be upheld. Is there a possibility that something else may or may not be the case is a question to be queried for any time one party is unhappy with the outcome. It's not a basis for a reversal when the facts below support the decision that was made.
The facts below don't show that the other parties didn't get their 25% payment either. So you don't have any facts to support your position either. So if we're going to say he doesn't have the facts, you don't have them either.
But what we have is the property law statute saying what happens in the absence of any facts, of any contrary facts.
But here's garnishment, and garnishment is factually specific.
So
factually specific.
You agree he's a one-fourth owner?
Yes.
You agree he's a tenant in common?
Yes.
But you just say the record's devoid of what happened with the first two of three payments?
Yes, and
so we should assume they're the way you say it went?
You should not make an assumption. You should instead decide on the property law that says 25% is the amount payable to him. The contrary arguments are all factual arguments, not based upon any facts that were before the court below or in the record here.
So what I'm hearing you say is we should send it back for the trial court for a determination of who received what part of those first two, and if it turns out that it was divided four ways, then you get your 25, and if it turns out that he was getting the lion's share of the last one, then you would get more.
No, because that's nothing more than a do-over. The opportunity to present those facts were wide open in the trial court, and this court should not reverse based on the fact that they now wish they had included other facts or thought there might be that there should, or non-facts. We simply have no idea. So to remand simply for a do-over is not the right outcome here.
How do you have, you're saying we don't need any facts. It doesn't matter. Even if everything that's been represented in the pleadings are true, we should not send it back. We should rely on some statute, but we're in garnishment. If we're in garnishment, how can we hop out of that and rely on what you're asserting that we should rely on?
Because I believe it's the best interpretation of the facts that are before the court in the record. It's simply the best information that we have applicable property law statute applied to it.
But garnishment requires us to know that to which the defendant was entitled, because if we don't know that, we don't know the amount that's actually subject to garnishment. So if you're saying what's been represented in the pleading is not true, I can understand that, but we still have to know that. We can't just give it to you because of a statute. We have to follow the garnishment law. And you can only garnish that which the defendant had a right to receive.
But that is directly what 700.21 answers.
It's not a garnishment statute. It's not fact-specific. You're trying to have us parse the word purchase price to mean the whole purchase price. I could parse the statute the other way and says purchase price is determined in increments in this case because that's what we have.
Tell me what you're resting on. Are you resting on this being a garnishment? Or are you resting on something else? Because I kind of hear you trying to combine theories to get your results.
A garnishment establishes the collection right here. The next question is then, what is the extent of that right, right? What is the property in the garnishee's hands? And 700.21 answers that.
Is it the property or is it the money? I mean, is it the physical land or is it the money?
In this case, it's the money. It's the proceeds that were being garnished. Personal property. I didn't mean to use that term loosely, property. So the money is the personal property.
You don't know where two-thirds of the proceeds are at this point.
The record doesn't show that, but what the amount that's payable to the debtor is answered by 700.21.
I don't disagree that there might be amounts that are payable. The issue becomes what can you garnish? Those are two different things, and I see you kind of conflating those ideas. I think that's what Justice Rogensack is repeatedly trying to get at, and I am too, because I need you to lead me down the path to why you go back in time to money that is who knows where to garnish it from this particular individual. It almost sounds like you're requiring us to make assumptions that just aren't in the record.
What I'm asking you to do is not make assumptions. Splitting the last payment up into quarters requires the assumption that the first two of the three were split up into quarters. What we're asking is that assumption not to be made, and that instead 700.21 answers the question of what property in the garnishee's hands is payable to the debtor, and is 25% of the contract price.
Okay, but all right, then we just go back to I get it. Then the idea is you just think they cut a bad deal. And
yes.
They should have made it clear as to how it was going to be divided up upon each payment. And because they didn't assert that and put it in the record at the trial court, they're out and they can sue their tenant in common and get another judgment and hope to collect someday.
That is a possibility here. It is just as likely, if not more, if all the payments were set aside to use to satisfy liens. This would normally be done when you're going to need to satisfy liens at the end of the contract. But we don't have facts to know which one of those is the case. And 700.21, which answers the question, is what the Court of Appeals properly relied on, properly concluded and decided on that and on the facts that are supportable by the record in this case. And that decision should be affirmed.
Counsel, I understand your argument. And I understand that hold otherwise makes assumptions that are not in the record. So you have to just, your position is that none of that was proved and that you're just going in that he is entitled to one-fourth, and if he's entitled to one-fourth of the total proceeds, you're entitled
yes.
to that one-fourth. I understand that. But in your discussion here, you indicated that doing what you ask makes the lemonade out of these lemons. When I say lemons, I mean all these facts, non-facts, assumptions, non-assumptions. And so my question to you is, do you make better lemonade out of this confused, to me, confused and confusing limited record? Is it better than to, why shouldn't we do partition? When we do a partition and we sell it, we're going to have all these facts. We're going to get the facts. We're going to get a fair market price. We're going to get a statement of the liens, whether they're on just James's interest or everyone else's interest. We're going to be able to know, did he already receive his one-fourth share of the other two payments, or didn't he, et cetera, et cetera. We can get the whole record. And under the equity power of the court doing the partition, we'll square all this away, and everybody knows that taxes come first. Unless you die, taxes come first, right?
Right.
And when you die, the taxes are there anyway, right?
Yes.
So you're not going to get cut out if we do a partition, when I don't mean we. Trial does a petition, and everybody is brought in. Anybody who walked past the property and says, oh, I got an interest, is brought in. Isn't that the simplest way of dealing with this?
I'll answer your question and note my light is on at the same time.
Yes, go ahead.
It's prejudicial because what that would do here
yeah.
is give to the Department of Revenue some portion of the sale proceeds, and that's a disputed amount, and then the lien, is deemed terminated. The maximum amount of the payment on the facts of this case is $85,000. The Department of Revenue's lien is over $100,000.
Sure.
So they are prejudiced. They get less than the full value of their property right in this property, and the lien is terminated. And that is done on the basis of a private contract negotiated 4 years prior with no opportunity to object. The other lien holders get no money at all, and their liens are terminated. That's prejudicial. And the circuit court had the discretion to make that equitable decision, and the decision was correct. But so they get less than the amount of their lien. That's the prejudice.
You know, that may happen. And there are other people that may get more or less. But we wind up with one proceeding in which there's power of the court to settle everyone out. I mean, you might lose, the Department of Revenue might lose several thousand, or not. I don't know. And I'm not trying to have you lose. It's to my interest that the Department of Revenue gets paid, because what the state picks up in revenue comes out for the court system in addition to everything else. So I'm interested, I say in a general way, of the department getting money, but I am also interested in settling this out once and for all in a fair way to everybody, and it just seems to me that partition does that, or has the ability to do that.
Yeah, I think there's two reasons partition isn't the best solution here. The partition, particularly, not partition at all, and particularly the partition that was proposed based on the private contract. The first is that it's prejudicial to lien holders because they're going to get less than the value of their lien. The second is that's an equitable remedy that really is being asked here to solve a contract problem and just release the sellers from a contractual obligation that they took on with the eyes presumably wide open. It's just not the right place for an equitable remedy to be used.
Well, the thing that the sellers agreed to was free and clear. Right?
That's right. Free of all liens. Right. And the liens were of record when they made that agreement. And what they're asking for now is an equitable remedy that cuts off the rights of the lien holder, said you don't get your full payment. Because they entered into a contract, they say they cannot now perform. That's not equitable.
What if the agreement was that he would get the big chunk in the first couple of payments so he could pay off these obligations and he just didn't do it?
I would just encourage the court.
I mean, how would you then, you can't, how do you go backwards to try to get that? What if he has a big goose egg coming, nothing coming out of the last 113,900?
That would have been something that he could have said to the court below and we would have had a record. I just want to encourage the court to not make a decision based on facts that we don't have.
Thank you very much.
And I think I can clear up the record issue. I don't want to take more of my time. There were two appeal cases which were consolidated here, and I suspect, based on my tabbing, that you have the appellate record from the one that didn't carry the substance, and the other one...
were consolidated. These
right.
two cases were consolidated.
And one right. of the two consolidated case numbers got the whole record, and I just suspect that you have the other one.
I'm sure that the marshal will look at the other number and will present it, because this is extraordinarily thin, I wondered what... Yeah, well, you can see that that's not before the court. We have an appendix, but even that doesn't and shouldn't have everything in the record. Okay.
Mr. Burnett, are you ready to do rebuttal? Thank you.
The principal argument that I just listened to was that we need to stick to the record. We need to confine ourselves to what's in the record. And there is some irony to that, because the Department of Revenue, which is receiving the benefit of this, filed nothing. There wasn't a motion. Whose responsibility is it to create a record that they are entitled to $85,000? It's certainly not my client's. The responsibility falls on the Department of Revenue to show there was a debt or property in the hands of Mr. Vandehei and how much it was. Pretty simple. But they didn't do it. The reason they didn't do it is because they never garnished in the first place. And the circuit court gave them a gift. It gave them a gift in an advisory opinion that said, while the issue has not been framed in front of me, I think the Department of Revenue gets this money. That's an advisory opinion. The second point I'd make is we heard a lot about 700.21 and how we have to follow that statute. That creates some kind of a presumption, although it doesn't. The question is, why would we indulge in that presumption on the last payment but not the first two? If we're going to presume anything from that statute, it should be that Mr. Vandehei received 25% of the first installment, which, by the way, was paid at the execution of the land contract according to its terms, never subject to garnishment, that he received 25% of the second installment months before Prince garnished. And why wouldn't we indulge in the same presumption on the third?
Counsel, one of my concerns is the trial court opinion and the sense that the trial judge was confronted with some of the same things that we are discussing here today in terms of information. The court on page 12 twice says, as I mentioned previously, at this time, specifically the court, the bottom of page 12 says, the court cannot at this time partition the entire sale of the property because two-thirds of the purchase price has already been paid to the sellers. Without more information, the court is not in a position to partition the land or the proceeds of the sale at this time. And then it goes on to say in the next paragraph, based on the information currently before the court, the terms of the original contract between the interveners, Vandenberg and Vandehey, will not be disturbed. Partition is therefore not equitable or appropriate at this time. So it seems to me that the trial court is saying that it doesn't have now the information to before it to know if this is the appropriate remedy. Your response earlier was partition now and information will follow. And the trial court is saying I don't have the information at the outset to order partition. Since this is an equitable proceeding and there is great deference, really, to the discretion of the circuit court, not unlimited deference, but great deference to the circuit court in this equitable proceeding, why shouldn't we say, okay, the judge was wrestling with lack of information and wasn't willing to go forward and order partition at this time? What's wrong with that?
Two things. Number one, the court never suggests what additional information it would like to see. Number two, it misappreciated Mr. Vandehey's position. It said, this is going to prejudice Vandehey. And that was just wrong. He moved for partition as an alternative to specific performance. And third, the courts, this is the problem with opinions without orders and judgments, because I don't know whether this is a dismissal with prejudice or without prejudice. So at a minimum, a remand to clarify whether it's a dismissal without prejudice, so an action for partition can be renewed and further supplemented. Justice Ziegler?
Partition of land or partition of funds?
Proceeds.
That's what I thought. But in that same order Justice Bradley was referring to, the judge said he wasn't ordering a partition of the land.
Or proceeds. He said both.
Well, You're pleading, but it's like the last line or two in the order, not in the body of it.
Your pleadings ask for partition of both the property, which you define as real estate, and
I think my pleading.
When you look at that order, though, at the end of the order, my recollection was the judge spoke of. I wondered if the judge fully appreciated the fact that there could be a partition of proceeds. Is what I'm saying.
Justice Bradley's passage that she read mentioned proceeds. The
except
pleading
conclusion and order, the part, the order.
Right.
Based on the foregoing, it's ordered. DOR can do this and that in these cases. The motions to partition the land and to order specific performance of land sale are denied.
Right.
Okay? So it wasn't a denial of your request to partition the funds. Do you see what I'm saying?
I see exactly what you're saying.
The body, but the conclusion and order is land specific.
I think that's right.
Which causes me to wonder if that helps or hurts your analysis.
I think it helps, but the subpart A of our third party summons and complaint, the wherefore clause, ask for a finding that judicial partition of the property is impossible or impracticable and that a judicial sale of the property is appropriate. So I think what we pled was a claim for partition of the proceeds. The
how do you get partition of proceeds unless you sell out the property?
I think you have to have a sale of the property.
Of course.
Yes, and but not a division of the property.
Pardon me?
But not a division of the property.
No, because this property may not be divisible into four acreage pieces. What you have to do here, if I understood all this, was that you had to sell this property, and then you had to divide up the proceeds.
Right.
And in that manner, you would get this property, I assume, free and clear, and the proceeds might be free and clear to some of the co-owners and not to others.
Correct. Correct. They would not be free and clear to Mr. Vandenberg.
That's right.
They would follow him and would be discharged when that happens.
And that's the way to clean it all up in one fell swoop.
That's right. And that's what the answer to the garnishee complaint recognizes. I mean, that answer is conclusive under 812.17 unless traversed, and that says the amount of my debt to Vandenberg is $28,000 and change. So, Justice Prosser?
The tax lien of the Department of Revenue had priority over Prince. Is that right?
I think so.
Would it have had priority over the M&I mortgage?
I don't believe so, but as I mentioned, I alluded to earlier, to the extent that was a mortgage filed before the tax warrants, but
six years before.
Yeah, I guess I'm going out on a limb that perhaps I shouldn't go out on.
Okay. Well, we don't have to worry about the debts. That maybe we'll get worried about later. We just need to worry about what do we do with the payment that's at issue.
Right, and what
and
I...
partition. Right.
The problem is we don't have these facts.
We don't have these facts, and the burden is on the department, if it truly advanced a garnishment claim, to prove the debt or the property that was in the hands of Mr. Vandehey, and it didn't. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. We really picked on you a lot today. It's a very, very interesting case, and notwithstanding the questions, and particularly my poking at you, I think you both did a very, very good job. I just happen to love these kind of cases that have commercial problems in them, and you did a wonderful job, and it's very, very interesting. So the court thanks you all for your assistance. We will try to look up the other part of the record. We have our trustee Marshall already working on it. So I think that concludes our argument today, and we are